From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. In July of 2018, producer Kate McMahon was vacationing with her family in Victoria, British Columbia. One morning, Kate made a discovery that would send her into a year-long reporting journey. So, Kate, tell us what happened that morning.
Well, I was going for a run, and I spotted a herd of deer in some woods across the road. So I decided to follow them to take video with my smartphone for my kids.
See, it's a mama, a daddy, and a baby fawn.
I realize I'm standing in this cemetery. One gravestone I'm standing over totally gives me chills.
Tanya Van Kuylenberg, 1969 to 1987. She parts her wings and then she's gone.
She was only 18 years old, I'm wondering. Car accident, drug overdose. And so I take a picture of her grave.
Why'd you take a picture?
It was just a moment of feeling like I wanted to put good thoughts out there for this girl's family, whoever they were. And then something mind-blowing happens later that night. I show my husband the photo, and he says, "I know that name." I don't believe him. We are in a foreign country, and I had followed deer into a random cemetery. So I go online and find out he's actually right. Tanya's name had been in the news that week, and I find out how she died. She and her boyfriend had been murdered 31 years before, and no one had been arrested until now.
We first aired this episode in October and are bringing it back today because there have been some developments. We pick up with Kate, piecing together the last day anyone saw the young couple alive.
It's November 18th, 1987, and this young Canadian couple, Tanya Van Kuylenberg and Jay Cook, are taking their first big trip together, alone. It's a short trip, just one night away from home. They're on an errand for Jay's dad, who needs them to buy a furnace part in Seattle. I recently retraced their steps. They board the ferry in Victoria Harbor in Jay's van and head to Port Angeles. But Tanya and Jay never make it to Seattle.
They left on a Wednesday, and they were to return basically by midday on Thursday was the expectation. And when they didn't return on Thursday, my parents were of the firm view that there was something wrong.
That's Tanya's big brother, John Van Kuylenberg. Meeting him for the first time, it strikes me that if Tanya had lived, she might have grown into certain traits like John. Courteous, gentle, dutiful. I notice a weariness in his eyes, though, and he fidgets with a water bottle as we talk. John tells me that 6 days after the couple went missing, the police called his family's home. They had found the body of a girl in a rural area just north of Seattle.
And and then my father and I had to identify her, and which unfortunately it was so Tanya. So that was the dark, very dark day.
What I'm about to describe is pretty gruesome. The killer had shot Tanya in the back of the head, execution style. A stranger's semen is found on her pants and in her body. Jay's van is found the next day, and his body the day after that, about 70 miles away from Tanya in another rural area. Jay's head had been beaten. He'd been strangled. A pack of cigarettes stuffed into his mouth.
There were just so many questions, no answers. The police couldn't give us any answers. They didn't know what the heck had happened. And, so you just had to, I think in the short term, you just kind of gave up.
The funeral takes place at the University of Victoria Chapel. There's standing room only.
It was, huge attendance. I mean, as often happens when young people die.
I asked John about the epitaph on Tanya's grave that says, "She parts her wings and then she's gone."
There was a line she'd written in some of her own poetry. And, it obviously struck my dad as being oddly eerie in one sense of her having left us too soon like that.
The case remains unsolved for the next few years. In 1990, it's featured in an episode of America's Unsolved Mysteries.
Next, the story of an innocent young couple whose romantic weekend was shattered by a sadistic and elusive killer.
The show interviews a Seattle police detective at the time who says surgical gloves were left behind by the killer.
He leaves those behind as basically a sign to the police that you needn't look for fingerprints because I wore these gloves. And he has confidence that there's nothing that's going to connect him with these crimes.
The story generates no viable leads. Years peel by. The families still have no answers from police. Then new hope. DNA is taking the place of the fingerprint as law enforcement's most cutting-edge tool. In 1994, the FBI creates a DNA database called CODIS. It contains genetic profiles of people who've been arrested or convicted of crimes. Police can compare DNA they recover from crime scenes with this database to identify suspects. In Tanya and Jay's case, police check CODIS periodically, but never find a match. The case goes cold until 2005. Detective Jim Scharf of the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office comes on the scene.
This is where we book all of the evidence in.
I meet Detective Scharf at the evidence room in Everett, Washington.
Package it here, log it into this computer.
He likes to go by Jim. He shows me the process of booking evidence using a roll of tape as an example.
So we're going to book this into evidence, so we're going to take it and we'd put it in a sack.
Jim seals up the sack, writes his initials on it, and sticks it in a locker. I'm struck by how, I don't know, analog it all seems.
And then shut it.
Jim has a neatly trimmed gray mustache, and his eyes are soft in the corners. When I ask him about restaurants in Everett, he tells me he usually just goes to Arby's. I glimpse a pistol under his jacket when he sits down.
I was a major crimes detective, and we were just getting ready to start the cold case team.
Jim reopened Tanya and Jay's cold case, and for more than a decade, he followed all kinds of leads. But like the detective before him, never found a DNA match in CODIS. Then, in 2017, he hears about a new way to use DNA to identify people.
Investigators say they were able to create these sketches of a possible suspect using DNA phenotyping.
Phenotyping is this revolutionary new forensics technology. It takes DNA from an unknown person and creates a computer drawing of what they look like.
It provided information of the person's, like, hair color, eye color, complexion.
The DNA found on Tanya generates three faces of a white man. First, as he appears at age 25 with reddish-brown hair. Then 45 and 65. He has deep facial lines and is going gray. To Detective Scharf, it's like staring the killer in the eye for the very first time. The phenotype helps. Scharf is able to vastly shrink the haystack of suspects by ruling out people who don't look like the sketch. But still, no DNA match. Then, in April 2018, news from California changes everything in the world of DNA and crime solving.
Tonight, a four-decade-old search for one of history's most infamous serial killers may be over.
We found the needle in the haystack.
Police announcing the capture of 72-year-old Joseph James DeAngelo, a man they say is the elusive Golden State Killer.
I'm like, who's the Golden State Killer? I've never even heard of this guy.
Scharf goes online and learns he's a serial killer and rapist who victimized more than 60 people in the 70s and 80s in Northern California. The alleged Golden State Killer was found with a mind-blowing new forensics technique called genetic genealogy.
Genetic genealogy is using DNA to learn more about someone's family history and family tree.
That's Cece Moore. She's one of the top genetic genealogists in the world. She even appears as the DNA expert on the hit PBS television series Finding Your Roots with Henry Louis Gates Jr.
She's a detective with skills that would put Sherlock Holmes to shame.
In addition to helping people trace their ancestors, Cece uses genetic genealogy to find the living, usually adoptees searching for their birth parents.
For any type of human identification, there really isn't anything more powerful than DNA and genetic genealogy.
There are two main reasons genetic genealogy is so powerful. First, because it reaches far beyond the FBI's CODIS database of convicts and people who've been arrested. And second, it incorporates much more genetic data. It's really complicated, but here's the gist of it. Law enforcement uses CODIS to analyze 20 genetic markers. Genetic genealogy analyzes about 800,000. It can identify very distant relatives and ancestors from generations ago. It casts a really wide net, but only works if it can access a lot of DNA profiles. By 2018, more than 25 million consumers had added their DNA to the leading ancestry databases. But those companies, like 23andMe and Ancestry.com, keep each other locked out of their customers' data. Police are locked out too, unless they get a court order. So what was the key in the Golden State Killer case? Well, there's this website called GEDmatch. It allows people who get their DNA tested by one company to compare their genetic profile with customers who used other companies. It's sort of like a DNA swap meet. And it's open access to the public.
If you tested 23andMe, I was at Ancestry DNA. We wanted to see if we shared DNA. We could both upload to GEDmatch without having to pay for another test.
In the beginning, only serious genealogists used GEDmatch. But in the case of the Golden State Killer, the cops got in and were able to access about a million users' genetic profiles.
Investigators found D'Angelo using DNA from crime scenes decades ago, which they submitted to a publicly shared genealogy website called GEDmatch.
It worked so well that GEDmatch decided to make clear that law enforcement can search it.
And they put a big notification on the homepage of GEDmatch that said, law enforcement used the database, we're allowing that use.
That's when Cece and a company called Parabon Nanolabs saw an opportunity and decided to team up. Parabon made the computer drawings of the suspect's face for Detective Scharf. He remembers getting a call from the CEO soon after the Golden State Killer arrest.
And he said, well, if you give me written permission, I'll upload our DNA profile to GEDmatch for you for free.
In other words, Parabon was offering to plug the DNA file from Tanya's crime scene into GEDmatch to try and find a relative of the killer.
So it was uploaded on, I think, a Friday, and I waited, no matches. Saturday morning, I woke up and there were matches, and I got to work on it.
The GEDmatch algorithm points her to people who share DNA with the unknown suspect. Then the family tree building comes in. I wanted to understand what it looks like, so I asked Cece to show me. We're in her living room with a view of the Pacific Ocean. She settles into her workplace, the sofa, and opens up her laptop. I see graphics pop up of a family tree with people represented in pink and blue blocks.
And all 800,000 genetic markers were compared to everyone else's genetic markers in the database. Then we get a list of people that share significant amounts of DNA with that unknown suspect.
She tells me the top two matches share about 3% of their DNA with the unknown suspect.
Which would mean that they're second cousins or similar. So that means that my first theory is they share great-grandparents with the suspect. So I have to figure out who these matches are, because sometimes it's not obvious.
But in Tanya and Jay's case, Cece's very first one that could lead to an arrest, the answer comes quickly. In just 2 hours, she finds the suspect that had eluded police for more than 3 decades. She shows me the path she took through the family tree. From those second cousins, she finds a family with 4 children. One is a son.
Yeah, the DNA is pointing to this one person, and this is the only other option. And so by Monday, we communicated that to Detective Scharf.
Jim is out walking his little black pug dogs when he gets a message from the CEO of Parabon to call him. He's got good news.
And I'm like, well, what's the good news? And he says, well, Jim, I've got a name for you. I don't think I can believe this. You got a name for me. And he goes, yep, we've narrowed it down to one individual. They found his mother's obituary, and the obituary said that she had, you know, 3 daughters and only 1 son. So it has to be that son. And I said, can you give me the name? And he said, it's William Earl Talbot II.
Jim runs Talbot's name through public records, finds out where he lives and works. But before he can make an arrest, Scharf has to prove Talbot is the exact match to the crime scene DNA. He needs to get a saliva sample from him.
If you can get a cigarette butt or a coffee cup or a soda bottle or something that's been in the person's mouth that has their saliva on it, that's a much better source of DNA to know that it's a reliable source.
What happens next might sound like a cop show on TV. For several days, Jim's team of detectives follow Talbot, scout his workplace, a trucking company, lurk outside his house. Then, while tailing him through Seattle, they get a breakthrough.
And he drove up to the stoplight at Spokane Street and stopped. And for some reason, he opened the door of the semi-truck. And when he did that, somebody spotted a white paper cup on the street underneath the door. And they're like, hey, I think that fell out of his truck.
One of the cops dashes out in the middle of traffic and grabs the cup in the street. Now Scharf has something he can work with. He takes the cup to the State Patrol crime lab and returns the next day to hear the results from the DNA supervisor.
She says, Jim, she says, you have a match. So I fight back the tears and I just screamed, we got him.
The plan for the arrest is set. It goes down in the yard of the trucking company after Talbot gets off work. Detective Scharf is waiting outside in plain clothes. There are undercover agents hiding in black ski masks and SWAT gear as backup. At about 6 p.m., Talbot walks out.
And I said, are you William Talbot? He said, yes. I said, I'm Jim Scharf. I'm a detective with the sheriff's office. I reach out. He reaches out. I shake hands with him.
Jim explains he's investigating a homicide case and needs to rule out suspects. He tells Talbot he's one of many people on the list.
He says, why don't you come back tomorrow or the next day? And I said, well, you know, we've come a long way. I says, can you give me your driver's license so I can check and see your ID to verify it's you? And he says, I told you who I am. So I could see that he was not going to cooperate. I said, okay, you're under arrest. Turn around and put your hands behind your back. And he says, what for? I said, for first degree murder.
Jim arrests Talbot. He'd finally cracked the unsolved murder of Tanya Van Kuylenberg and Jay Cook that had haunted their families for decades. He calls Tanya's brother, John.
So, yeah, I remember he told me that, yeah, we've arrested him, John. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. I said, well, where is he? He says, in the back seat. And I'm like, what? So all of a sudden, after 31 years, like, here's Jim, this great guy. And he's telling me he's in the same vehicle as this guy at this point. And I remember a chill went down my spine. I was just like, it was just a real moment of realization, like, holy cow, like, there's actually, this is really, really concrete. And yeah, it was fantastic.
So after three decades, police arrest a suspect in a murder case that had seemed unsolvable. For Tanya and Jay's family members and for police, genetic genealogy seems like the greatest invention ever for solving crime. But some people worry that this powerful tool could be turned into a weapon.
Wouldn't it be terrible if our DNA information was used to persecute and prosecute people that didn't agree with them politically?
You're listening to Reveal.